From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the challenges facing the FBI in preventing terrorist attacks. The Bureau investigated the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, but never came up with actionable information.
This was an aggressive investigation. You know, when they're sending in an undercover informant and when you're getting warrants for wiretapping his phone calls, they clearly believe that he might be a danger.
We talk with New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau. He covers national security, the Justice Department, and the FBI. He says the FBI is increasingly using undercover stings to try to catch terrorists before they act, a practice that gets mixed results and, critics say, ensnares people who would otherwise never have committed a crime. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Kathleen Shine's new novel about family, loss, aging, and resilience. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the late Alan Toussaint's final album, American Tunes. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The bombing of the airport in Turkey and the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando are the latest tragedies showing how difficult it is to catch terrorists before they attack. The FBI twice investigated the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, as a potential terrorist and decided to close his case. The FBI has always faced a tough challenge in tracking terrorist threats, but it's even harder now that lone actors are committing mass murders using guns in a nation filled with easily accessed firearms. On today's show, we're going to talk about how the FBI tries to identify suspected terrorists and foil their plots, and whether watch lists are an effective tool. Our guest is Eric Lischblau. He's an investigative reporter at the New York Times Washington Bureau, covering national security and the Justice Department. In 2006, he and James Risen won the Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for breaking the story of the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Lischblau spoke yesterday with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Eric Lischblau, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Great to be here. Thank you, Dave.
Let's start by talking about Omar Mateen, the shooter in the massacre in Orlando. The FBI, we know, did investigate him. What drew their attention to Omar Mateen?
Right. They actually looked at him twice in the years before the shooting. The first time was an investigation into some disturbing comments that he had made to coworkers of his. He worked as a security guard for a private security company, G4, and was working the courthouse duty, and was heard making a whole string of comments claiming that relatives were tied to terrorism, Al-Qaeda, that he wanted to martyr himself, you know, some troubling and disturbing and incendiary remarks. So these were passed on to the FBI, and that alone was grounds enough to open an investigation, a preliminary investigation into him. And they worked that pretty hard. They used an undercover informant to try and see whether he was really planning anything. They did surveillance. They did wiretapping. They interviewed the coworkers, obviously. They extended the investigation past the 6 months that they were originally allowed to go. And after about 10 months, they closed it down. They said they did not have enough evidence to indicate that he was supporting terrorism or planned to act on his earlier comments. And in fact, they interviewed him, and he claimed that this was said out of anger in response to what he thought was ridiculing from his coworkers. So he said he was making this stuff up, essentially, because he wanted to respond to their ridicule. And the FBI kind of threw up its hands and closed the investigation. So that was the first time. That was in 2012, 2013, into 2014. And then just a few months after that, through really coincidence, his name surfaced in a much more serious investigation at that point into a suicide bomber from Florida, a guy by the name of Abdus Salah, the first American suicide bomber in Syria as part of ISIS. And Mateen's name surfaced there as someone who had gone to the same mosque as Abdus Salah and had known him apparently casually. So they looked at him again, and they interviewed him again. They interviewed him a total of three times between that first investigation and the second time. And he said he didn't know much about him, and there was no evidence to contradict that. So, yeah, you had this difficult situation where the FBI had this guy on their radar twice within a period of about 2 years before the shootings in Orlando, and did not and was unable to act on it.
Was he on a watch list over the course of this?
He was on a watch list. He was on a watch list for almost a year until about 2014. He was on the FBI's watch list. He was on a no-fly list. But what happened at the end of that, once the investigation was closed, his name was taken off the watch list. Now, that's actually a sign of the progress in the watch list, where lots of people complained for years and years that their names were improperly put on watch lists, and they remained on those lists for years afterwards, and it was almost impossible to get your name off. The fact that he was taken off the watch list so quickly was a sign of progress in terms of civil liberties.
So once that investigation was closed, it was a matter of Justice Department policy to take him off the list?
Exactly. The FBI had been criticized before that for keeping people on those lists too long, even though they had been cleared, in effect, of any criminal charges. And so in the last few years, the FBI had gone to great lengths to do a better job of taking people's names off those lists once the investigations were closed. And he was one of thousands and thousands of people whose names were then much more quickly and efficiently taken off those lists. And so at the end of the day, we're left with this sad and ironic situation.
If he had still been on the list, would that have affected his ability to buy the weapons that he did?
Yes and no. Under the law, he still would have been able to walk into a gun shop, even if his name was on a terrorist watch list, and still buy a gun. That's been a matter of intense debate in Washington for the last few years. The critics call it the terror gap, the fact that you can be on a terror watch list and be prevented from getting on a plane, but you could still buy a gun. What could have happened if he were still on that terror watch list as of earlier this month was that the FBI at least would have been pinged, would have been notified, in theory, when he went in to buy that semi-assault weapon and a 9mm pistol. And at least they would have known. Would that have done any good? Impossible to say. But someone on the Joint Terrorism Task Force who had looked at him earlier would have at least been cognizant that, hey, this guy who we looked at 2 years ago just went in to buy some pretty serious firepower. What does that mean? They couldn't have stopped it because, remember, being on a terrorist watch list is not a prohibited category. And if at the end of 3 days there is nothing stopping the sale, it can automatically go through. Once that happens, the process is over. There's no registry that can be kept after the fact. And the NRA and gun rights people have fought very hard to make sure that there is not a national registry, per se, of firearms. The process is all front-ended to see whether or not someone is allowed to buy a gun or not. And after that, after the sale goes through, those records are then destroyed.
We hear a lot about terrorism watch lists. Can you clarify how many lists are there? What distinguishes them?
Yeah, there's really not a single list. There's a whole catalog of lists, if you will. There's a master list that's kept by the intelligence community, by the National NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center, which has, believe it or not, 1.5 million names on it. Most of those are overseas. Only about 15,000 at last count were U.S. residents. So most of those are what are seen as foreigners with terrorist ties, most of them in the Middle East or in countries seen as supporting terrorism. Now, within different agencies, such as the FBI, which we talked about, or DHS, its component agencies, TSA being the big one, those in charge of flights, they all have their own lists. So this has been an enormous growth industry, really, since 9/11 in the last 15 years. At the time of the 9/11 attacks, there were a total of 16 names on the no-fly list. Now there are anywhere from 80 to 90,000 just on the no-fly list portion, and then hundreds of thousands more on other lists. So the result of 9/11 was to err on the side of caution whenever possible. And if you're not sure whether someone could be a threat, put their name on the list. And as we talked about earlier, the civil liberties implications were huge because lots of people ended up on the list who probably should never have been in the first place. And it was very, very difficult, and still is in some cases very difficult, to get your name off of that. There are Muslim Americans who have sued and are continuing to sue the Justice Department and the federal government because they believe they've been racially profiled, that their names are on there just because, in some cases, just because of their religion or their names. There have even been members of Congress. Ted Kennedy, the late Ted Kennedy, was one famous example. His name was apparently similar to someone overseas, and he was put through secondary screening at the airport. John Lewis, civil rights icon, another person who showed up on one of the lists. It's oftentimes difficult to tell why someone ended up on the list in the first place, whether it was because of a case of mistaken identity, that they had a name similar to someone else's, or was it racial or ethnic profiling, or was this person a real terrorist threat? But the bottom line is that there are now, as I said, 1.5 million names on the biggest of all lists.
You know, the Orlando case presents this troubling example of someone who was investigated and apparently cleared by the FBI, felt they didn't have enough information to go forward to keep him even on a watch list. And then, of course, the massacre occurred afterwards. How many FBI terrorism investigations are open at any one time? Do we know?
There are about 1,000 open investigations at the FBI right now into what they call homegrown violent extremists, which are people that they believe were inspired by foreign terrorists, and that's overwhelmingly Islamic radicals, and people who are being watched because they fear that they may become lone wolves or may become Omar Mateens who act out in terrorist attacks. So that number has grown quite a bit in the last few years.
Eric Lichtblau is an investigative reporter at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Eric Lichtblau. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times covering national security matters and the Justice Department. We're talking about FBI investigations into potential terrorism suspects in the wake of the Orlando shootings. You know, it's ironic that just a few days before the Orlando shootings, you had a major piece in the Times about the expanded use of undercover operations by the FBI, particularly in cases of suspected involvement of terrorists associated with ISIS. Let's talk about that again. Let's just start with a very basic, simple question. When we say an undercover operation, how is that different from a standard investigation?
Sure. These are basically stings where the FBI has identified someone they see as a potential threat, in this case because of support for ISIS. Now, overwhelmingly, these people have been identified because of things they have said or done on social media through either semi-public forms, through Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram, or what they're seeing more and more is encrypted communications that the FBI has been able to break. And they want to know, are these people serious about some of the things they've said? Now, it's not a crime to say, I hate America or you go ISIS. But if that's taken to the next level, if you are pledging allegiance and support for ISIS, that could conceivably be a crime. So the FBI, depending on how much of a threat they think someone is, has been resorting more and more to undercover operations, not just monitoring these people, but sending in either actual FBI agents to pose as jihadists or ISIS sympathizers or sometimes even gun dealers or bomb makers or using informants in an undercover capacity. Those aren't FBI employees, but they're sort of acting as agents of the FBI to really determine their intentions. And what we found was that with ISIS occupying a greater place of concern for the FBI in the last 18 months, they have resorted increasingly to these undercover operations. Now about 2 out of every 3 FBI investigations into suspected ISIS supporters, they are approving undercover investigations to do that, which is a much higher percentage than we saw just a few years ago with these ISIS cases. So they're using very aggressive methods, not just as undercover observers, but really as participants in cases to say, here, help us out in buying some guns for an attack. Help us out with setting up a bomb to attack a synagogue.
You know, it must be much more time-consuming and expensive to do an undercover sting where you have to give someone a false identity and take all this care and time with it. Is that being done more frequently now because terror networks have changed and the way they connect or operate with international accomplices has evolved?
Well, I think it reflects a couple of things. It reflects, first of all, the concern about ISIS, which has risen tremendously in the last 18 months or so, as its prominence in the Middle East has risen. It reflects the difficulties of social media encryption. And what the FBI says is their frustration with going dark, that the terrorists on social media have found encrypted platforms, WhatsApp or other platforms, where it is much more difficult than it was before to find out what they're really saying and doing. So they feel that they need to send in these undercover operatives to develop a relationship of confidence where they can actually communicate with them in unencrypted ways and find out their intentions. So those are two of the biggest factors that explain why they have been moving so aggressively in these undercover investigations.
You know, there's also the phenomenon of the lone wolf, the person who is acting on their own with inspiration perhaps from other terrorists. And I thought we would play a clip here. This is from Adam Gadan. Do I have the name right, I think?
Gadan, yes.
An Al-Qaeda spokesman. And this is a video from 2011 where he is encouraging Americans to take action.
America is absolutely awash with easily obtainable firearms. You can go down to a gun show at the local convention center and come away with a fully automatic assault rifle without a background check and most likely without having to show an identification card. So what are you waiting for?
Well, that's pretty chilling.
He's clearly trying to sort of exploit the debate in America over access to guns and for purposes of ISIS propaganda.
Right, and I guess the challenge for the FBI is you're not just looking for people who may be getting finances or instructions from someone in the Middle East, but you have to figure out, among those who have radical feelings and passions, who among them are going to undertake an act like this? And the way to do it, apparently, is to have someone in a sting operation suggest something and see who bites.
Right, right. So who is actually going to act on these beliefs? There may be many thousands of people who have sort of sympathies for radical extremism or for ISIS, but who is actually going to act on it?
You describe a number of cases where this was done. You want to take one of them and tell us what the FBI did and what resulted?
Sure. There was a case in Rochester, New York, last December, where a local homeless man was thought to have been espousing views in support of ISIS, and they sent in several undercover operatives, and one of them even took the target of the investigation to Walmart. He drove him there to buy tools to be used in the attack, wrist bindings and a machete and ski masks. And the guy had no money, so the undercover agent had to spot him the $40 to cover the cost of his weapons and equipment for the attack, and then they arrested him. And there are cases like that all around in North Carolina, in Florida, where the FBI undercover agents were playing very, very aggressive roles. This is something we talked to the FBI about, and they make no bones about it, the fact that they believe they have to be very aggressive in playing a role to see whether these guys are serious about attacks or not.
Yeah, you talk about a case in Florida of a guy who, and the FBI agent suggested attacking a synagogue and then introduced him to a purported explosives expert who was actually an undercover agent, gave him the fake bomb. There's also the case of the Newburgh sting in Newburgh, New York, where there was a documentary about this where...
That was a fascinating case before ISIS, where the judge was clearly very, very troubled. She said in sentencing these four guys in Newburgh that had it not been for the FBI, there would have been no plot. The FBI, in her view, created this entire situation, and yet she thought her hands were tied and sentenced all four of them to prison time, because the FBI, at the end of the day, can point to its record of convictions in all of these cases since 9/11, and they have never been found to have breached the line of entrapment in Newburgh or in any of these other cases. They've been very aggressive, but they've been, in the view of the FBI and the judges, within the bounds of the law.
What exactly is the line? If they're dealing with someone who espouses radical views, but they, in effect, brainstorm the crime and provide the implements of the crime, under what circumstances can the target be legitimately charged and convicted?
If they can legitimately say that the person was predisposed to that mindset, that the FBI did not introduce the idea of radicalism to them, they can do an awful lot after that point. If they have identified someone who has already shown a proclivity towards a radical mindset, they can really go step by step in a purported plot, introducing fake Stinger missiles, as they did in that Nuremberg case, and another case in Albany and others, fake bomb makers, fake gun dealers, fake attacks on synagogues or local establishments. As long as they're not just sort of willy-nilly identifying someone and introducing the idea, if they can say, this is someone who is already walking down that road and we just sort of led him there a little bit quicker, they've upheld that in court.
You mentioned in the Rochester case that there was a homeless man that was induced to go buy some material for some terrorist acts. Are there cases in these investigations where the FBI is targeting people who may be mentally unstable or in some way mentally handicapped?
Sure. In that Rochester case, the defense attorney did say that basically this was a mentally ill homeless man who had no real ability to carry out an attack and may have been delusional, if anything. And that defense comes up in any number of these cases where you have guys of sort of limited abilities, limited means to carry out an attack. But what the FBI will say is that there are a lot of mentally ill guys who can do a lot of damage, and that that's not going to be a reason to write someone off as a suspect.
We're listening to the interview Dave Davies recorded with Eric Lischblau, an investigative reporter for The New York Times. After a break, they'll talk about how the FBI has remade itself in the years since 9/11. Also, Maureen Corrigan will review Kathleen Shine's new novel about one person's physical and mental decline and its effects on the entire family. And Kevin Whitehead will review the final album by the late pianist and songwriter Alan Toussaint. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Eric Lischblau, who covers national security, the Justice Department, and the FBI for The New York Times. They're talking about the challenges the FBI faces in identifying and catching terrorists before they attack. Lischblau recently wrote about how the FBI is increasingly using sting operations to try to catch terrorists.
On the FBI sting operations, in these cases, FBI agents go undercover, and those are folks that are full-time FBI people, and they have, you know, careers to think about and some level of control and supervision. To what extent do they use civilian informants who might be less reliable?
Yeah, many of the undercover investigations do rely on undercover informants. These are non-employees. These are people who sometimes are paid informants, sometimes are looking for a break in perhaps in criminal cases that they themselves have pending against them. And they are under supervision of FBI agents, and they are, you know, sent in sometimes with specific instructions to try and lure a suspect, if you will, into saying or doing things that may rise to the level of criminal activity.
And are they problematic? Is their conduct different from an agent in ways that we should worry about?
Well, you certainly don't have the accountability with an informant that you do with an agent. The problem is we often may not know a lot from the public record as to what the informant is doing to get into the middle of a plot. We only know as much as the Justice Department is willing to tell us in public filings for the most part. Sometimes we're able to find out more as reporters through our own reporting, but there is not the scrutiny on these informants that there is on FBI employees themselves.
You know, FBI agents, investigators are people, too, and anybody involved in a project at work wants to show a result, right? I mean, you want to get your target. You want to, you know, you want to advance your career by building a case. And it surely must be tempting at times to push it as far as you can. And I don't know if you're comfortable expressing an opinion, but in the cases you've looked at, how do you feel like they've gotten it about right?
Yeah, that's the overarching question, is whether the FBI has picked its spots correctly. Have they gone about identifying the real threats, the real possible lone wolves out there, or are they just going after people who have espoused unpopular views? And that's such a difficult question to answer. The civil liberties advocates would say that not just the FBI, but the intelligence community in general since 9/11 has cast too wide a net when it comes to surveillance and undercover operations and a range of counterterrorism measures. But whenever we see a spike in threats, whether it's after Orlando or after the Paris attacks or San Bernardino, the pendulum inevitably shifts towards doing more, not less.
I think you made the point in that piece that one difference between a standard investigation, for example, involving a wiretap, and an undercover operation, you need to get a warrant to do a wiretap, but an undercover operation can proceed on the Justice Department's own initiative.
Correct. With a wiretap, a judge is involved, and there has to be a showing of probable cause. With undercover investigations, that's up to the FBI and the Justice Department, a supervisor there, to approve that. Now, the FBI and the Justice Department will tell you that's still a fairly high bar and that they are not going off without significant evidence, but there's not the check, there's not the court oversight that there is in these other cases. And one of the added benefits in the FBI's view of these undercover investigations in going against ISIS is that the ISIS sympathizers have shown an ability to strike more quickly. The FBI will say that in the old days against Al-Qaeda, 8, 10, 12 years ago, it might be months or sometimes even years before a plot took root and actually was executed. Whereas the ISIS sympathizers, these lone wolves, may be radicalized in a matter of weeks, and the so-called flash to bang period, the period between someone's inspired and the period when they act, may be very, very quick, and they need to go in quickly.
You know, in the piece that you wrote about undercover investigations, you noted that it's not just the FBI, that a lot of other government agencies are expanding undercover operations. What kind of agencies? With what effect?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, since 9/11, the mindset has been more aggressive surveillance, more aggressive undercover. And so there are now upwards of 40 federal agencies doing undercover work that did not do it before. Medicare fraud, there will be undercover operatives posing as doctors. At the IRS, there's been an increase in accountants posing undercover. Even at the Supreme Court, at Supreme Court protests, we found that there will be undercover protesters looking for security threats. So it's really been a cottage industry for the federal government in terms of this boom in undercover work. And in the post-9/11 age, that's all been seen as necessary for the sake of national security.
Well, a lot of these things involve, you know, things like Medicare fraud or abuse of food stamps, right? Is it just sexier to have a sting operation and then have a big press conference?
I think that the agents see it as sort of a cool part of their job and more effective in some ways. If you can send someone in, you're oftentimes going to get faster results and more effective results than just sort of watching an investigation play out. And we've seen a huge boom in that in the last 10, 15 years.
Do agencies running undercover operations ever run up against another agency also doing an undercover operation?
That does happen. That does happen where you have like the FBI and the DEA not knowing that the other had an undercover presence, especially on the law enforcement side with ATF and DEA and FBI. That does happen more often than they would like.
They ever pull guns on each other?
That is rare. I think there have been one or two cases of that before they get up their badges and say, hey, we're on the same side as you.
I was surprised to read the Supreme Court itself has 150 police officers, and they themselves go undercover to do what?
Right. Yeah, at protests outside the Supreme Court, whether it's abortion protests or affirmative action or anything else, the last few years the Supreme Court has built up an undercover squad that sends people out dressed as protesters right into the center of the protests to see whether anyone is, you know, leaving a suspicious package or planning any sort of an attack. That was one of the ones that most surprised us in our reporting.
Eric Lischblau is an investigative reporter for The New York Times in their Washington Bureau covering national security and the Justice Department. In 2005, you and your colleague James Risen broke this huge story about the warrantless wiretapping program underway by the National Security Agency, which kind of reshaped the American debate on surveillance in the modern era. Update us on where that stands. Where is the program still active? What's going on?
Sure. It's taken a different format now. It's really become institutionalized in the last 7 or 8 years after the FISA Amendments Act and then the Protect America Act in 2007, 2008. A lot of the things that George W. Bush's administration was doing more or less on its own authority outside the boundaries of the court have now been written into the law. And so what we saw happen, at least before the disclosures by Edward Snowden, was that the NSA was gathering enormous amounts of bulk metadata and using that to develop telephonic records, patterns, and surveillance activities. What happened after Edward Snowden was that there was, of course, a backlash to that, and the metadata program has now been reined in, and the NSA's powers in that regard have really been curtailed pretty significantly. So the pendulum, as we talked about before, keeps swinging back and forth. Right now, when it comes to surveillance, the NSA has been more restricted than it had been just a few years ago.
You know, there is this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, this court that was designed to exercise some control over surveillance in these investigations. And you write that it's been regularly making decisions and establishing law almost like a second Supreme Court on certain issues of privacy. You want to just explain this a bit?
Sure. When it comes to surveillance law, yeah, the FISA court has really created a whole body of law in secret, especially in the years before the Edward Snowden revelations in 2013. There were really broad laws being written, interpretations of the law being written in secret by the FISA court as to what the NSA and the intelligence community could do in the name of national security with no real outside scrutiny. One of the reforms that took place as a result of the Snowden revelations was that at least there's now an adversarial party, if you will, in that courtroom to act as a check to say, hang on, we think there's another side to this other than what the Justice Department is presenting. So that is one mark of progress. But there are other areas where the secret opinions being issued by the FISA court have, you know, essentially been written into law without even scrutiny or review by the Supreme Court.
And literally secret opinions? I mean, we literally don't know what they are?
They are literally secret opinions. Only a handful of opinions from the FISA court have ever become public, and the rest of them remain secret.
So do we know how they've affected our rights and privacy?
Not really. not to put too fine a point on it, but no, we get leaks with Edward Snowden. We got sort of a flood of leaks, and some of those opinions and orders became public. But if it's not for that, we it's a lot of guesswork as to how the court and the intelligence community are really operating.
I think you're in as good a position as anybody else to answer this. How good a job has the FBI done since 9/11 of keeping us safe?
Well, the thing that's most certain is that the FBI has managed to remake itself as an intelligence agency. Before 9/11, counterterrorism was a part of its mission. It is now its overwhelming mission. So they have succeeded in really turning around this enormous agency and redirecting their efforts. Everyone at the Bureau knows that stopping a terrorist attack is now their main priority. And that's at the expense of white-collar crimes, of a whole range of other kinds of crimes that they used to pay more attention to than they do now. They've been very aggressive. Now, lately, we've had a string of incidents, beginning with San Bernardino and carrying on into Orlando, where there has been significant carnage. And so I think the FBI is looking to see what more could they be doing and should they be doing.
Eric Lischblau, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Eric Lischblau spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Lischblau covers national security and the Justice Department for the New York Times. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan will review Kathleen Shine's new novel about family, loss, aging, and resilience after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T.
This is Fresh Air. Aging is a hot subject these days, particularly in memoirs. Kathleen Shine's new novel explores how one character's physical and mental decline ripples out and becomes a family affair. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Shine's novel called They May Not Mean To, But They Do.
Kathleen Shine's latest novel is full of pee. It opens on a Lear-like vision of an old man who stumbles out of his Upper East Side Manhattan apartment, urine-soaked pajamas and adult diapers collapsed around his ankles. Images of the weak-bladdered follow, a poorly housebroken dog who requires puppy pads, an elderly woman who frequents the ladies' room, a drunken young man charged with public urination. Shine's book, which is called They May Not Mean To, But They Do, may be the only novel I've ever read that relies on pee as its major symbol. And what a unifying symbol it is! Cross-generational, stinging, and humiliating, that omnipresent tinkle reminds us of our common fragility, of what a leaky vessel we're all in throughout this voyage of life. If Shine's title sounds familiar, you know your nasty poetry. It's from Philip Larkin's infamous poem about family called This Be the Verse. The first stanza, which I must edit, reads, "They bleep you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you." That poem serves as Shine's lodestar throughout this compact novel of manners about family, loss, aging, and resilience. At one point, Joy Bergman, the 86-year-old Jewish matriarch of this tale, cites Larkin's lines but flips them, reflecting that her adult children can, in their own way, mess up their parents. And the mixture of comedy and despair in Larkin's verse has pretty much been Shine's signature tone ever since her first novel, Alice in Bed, about a sexually active college student who finds herself partially paralyzed and stuck in a hospital room. Shine's latest book takes readers back to the sickbed for a space, but this time the prone patient is at the end of his biblically allotted lifespan. Aaron Bergman, the diapered and damp figure I alluded to earlier, is dying of old age. The early chapters of this book dramatize what a toll Aaron's long fall through palliative care to hospice to death takes on his wife, adult children, and grandchildren. Through the novel's omniscient narrator, we get a panoramic vision here of exhaustion. For instance, daughter Molly, who lives in California with her wife, flies back to New York several times within a few months to tend to her parents, to try to organize their medications in little plastic boxes labeled with the days of the week, and set up Spotify and program it to endlessly play Frank Sinatra. Joy suffers a minor stroke and a scary infection, courtesy of her close daily contact with her dying husband's colostomy bag. When Aaron finally does die, it's a relief to his family and a mundane tragedy. Here's Joy waking up in the apartment the couple shared for decades. Joy woke up, and as usual, Aaron was dead. What was coming was clear to her. And it was a vast emptiness, a blank, much like the winter with its white horizon, dense and low, no distance to the sky at all. Her daughter Molly had gotten her a medical alert contraption that came with a wristband with a button on it. Sometimes she pushed the button by accident, and a man's voice from the machine asked her if she was all right. It was company. I bet some of you are thinking, who needs a novel about colostomy bags and grief? Oh, but you do need Shine's novel. At least you do if you're a reader who relishes acute psychological perceptions and lots of laughs to leaven the existential grimness. Like those other literary domestic goddesses to whom she's sometimes compared, Jane Austen and Nora Ephron, Shine can't help but crack a joke at the most inappropriate moments. Thus, we're told that poor Aaron was prescribed various painkillers that teenagers in shrinking Midwestern towns abused. The fun and bad behavior really kicks into high gear when the widow Joy meets an old flame who proposes to lift her out of her grief. That's when her loving adult children begin behaving like the graying toddlers that deep down they also still are. Does anyone really ever do anyone else any good? That's the question this sparkling and sad novel mulls over and answers with a wry shrug. After all, as Larkin told us, imperfect as we may be, we're all we've got.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed They May Not Mean To, But They Do by Kathleen Shine. After we take a short break, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the posthumously released final album by pianist and songwriter Alan Toussaint. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. New Orleans pianist, singer, songwriter, arranger, and producer Alan Toussaint died suddenly last November at age 77. The month before, he'd completed recording the second album he made with producer Joe Henry. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes the sequel better than the original.
Alan Toussaint, New Orleansifying Fats Waller's Viper's Drag, from the pianist's final album, American Tunes. It's a belated sequel to The Bright Mississippi, also produced by Joe Henry, which placed Toussaint among musicians from way outside his circle. On that one, the lack of a New Orleans drummer seemed to tie one hand behind Toussaint's back, and a Dixielandy band made some hip musicians sound corny. The second pass at the concept has its bumps, but works better. Guests like Bill Frisell and Charles Lloyd are less intrusive, and returning Los Angeles drummer Jay Belrose and bassist David Pilch sound more at ease. Earl Hines' tune Rosetta from Alan Toussaint's American Tunes. As on The Bright Mississippi, the repertoire is meant to connect the New Orleans great with broader American traditions. He could be charming and funny, and so could Fats Waller, so why not do Viper's Drag? There are tunes by fellow pianists Billy Strayhorn and Bill Evans, a couple of Professor Longhair Crescent City standards, and an 1850s dance by Louis Moreau Gottschalk, the New Orleans composer who brought Cuban syncopations to American sheet music. That harp and cello sweetening and the second piano part are by arranger Van Dyke Parks. He also joins the leader on a two-piano version of the only Toussaint standard on the program. One highlight of Alan Toussaint's late-period songbook concerts, in which he warmly thanked stars who made his songs hits, was the way he reclaimed his mysterioso tune Southern Nights from the memory of Glen Campbell's polka version. The blur of two pianos is like an evening mist descending over the melody. On Alan Toussaint's final album, Carolina Chocolate Drop Rhiannon Giddens drops by to sing Duke Ellington's Rocks in My Bed and Come Sunday. Alan Toussaint's only vocal is on Paul Simon's American Tune, where producer Joe Henry does something I'd never have seen coming. He makes Toussaint sound like 70s crooner Cat Stevens.
Oh, but I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home.
On his valedictory album, American Tunes, Alan Toussaint also plays four pieces solo, so we can better appreciate his touch and timing at the keys and how deeply steeped he was in the rolling New Orleans piano tradition epitomized by Professor Longhair. The record's a fond last look at a composer and pianist who helped refine classic New Orleans pop and rhythm and blues and then brought them into the modern era. We miss him already.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed American Tunes, the final album by the New Orleans pianist Alan Toussaint, who died last November. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be actor Matt Ross. On Silicon Valley, he plays the head of the tech giant Hooli. On Big Love, he was the son of a polygamous cult leader. Now Ross has written and directed the new movie Captain Fantastic about a father living off the grid with his six children. Also, we'll listen back to an interview with Elvis's longtime guitar player, Scotty Moore. He died yesterday. He was 84. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week. From grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns, Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. We'll be right back.